or hijab that people who choose it, people who want to wear it, should be able to wear it. Nobody should be forced to wear it, but everyone who wants to wear it should wear it. So it shows they have a hatred for modesty, and also Belgium and I think some of these other countries, you know.
I think Islamophobia plays a great role over there. We'll be back after a short while.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Well, Fatima, I'll tell you, I was just going through one of the videos on the internet, and I saw a boy doing so many struggles, making jokes to gain the viewers, to gain the followers. Mm-hmm. In case you want to earn a number of followers in a very less number of days, you don't need to do anything. You need to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it's said like that? If you're going to washroom, take a selfie.
Yeah,
if you're going out of washroom, take a selfie.
Or
if
in
you're
the going, TikTok
whatever
videos,
you're doing from
all these TikTok videos, yeah.
Exactly. To gain
for
followers.
For the physical attraction, I mean, just to posting all the, especially the young girls, they always want to post wearing the makeup and attractive clothes. It's just people are lonely. People are out there looking around. It's just physical attraction.
Well, Siddiqa said that women have been lowered.
I think because woman's beauty is more beautiful when she's modest. I mean, that's the examples we have from Hazrat Zahra, salam alayha, Hazrat Zainab, salam alayha, all of their modesty. But when you can just see all the beauty, it becomes like cheap, you know, it's like she loses her beauty. But I think women have been tricked into this, that I need to get attention. This is a way for me to get higher self-esteem. Unfortunately, in the West, the girls are taught from the early childhood by their parents, even by their moms, which is the most sad, and everyone in the society, that to get high self-esteem, to get successful in this life, you need to be able to attract men, even as young girls. And it's so gross. But like,
so
those of us
taught
that are raised Muslim, like in my time, they were kind of more strict. Nowadays, a lot of the Muslim families are not as strict about the hijab. But at that time, they were more strict. In the U.S., we had a really strong Shia Muslim community, alhamdulillah. That time they were more strict, but nowadays I'm seeing a lot of the fathers, they're not even teaching their kids, their daughters, as much about hijab as much. So the girls are not understanding. And I'm seeing this whole thing nearby countries. My friend from Lebanon said that there's girls who are wearing hijab, but then that's a different topic maybe, and they're putting makeup and making the hijab like attractive. The hijab is supposed to be there to not to attract, but they're making it like an attractive and like all these different, it's okay to look nice. We should look nice. No one's saying you have to be like full face veil and just sitting in the house and never leave the house, you know, and you can look nice wearing hijab, but it's not supposed to attract. And so they're making it like this attractive hijab. And then for the people who don't know about Islam, they're not Muslim, they're really taught to, you know, this is a part of the self-esteem and the success. And even in the career, in the workplace, a lot of places they will not hire. I experienced this in the U.S. They will not hire you just because of the hijab. And they say, we don't have any discrimination based on religion, all of that. They do. They'll sit there and say, come for the interview. They're so excited when you talk on the phone and like, come right away. You come there, you know, and I would wear like, even like, I'm not wearing chador, you know, like a nice jacket and pants and full covered and nice scarf and everything. Okay. We're not hiring anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
They will be direct. And so this is a discrimination, unfortunately. And I think it's just really sad. I mean, this is what's taught to the girls.
Well, since you're from California and you have witnessed all that discrimination, unfortunately. Yeah. Coming to you, Siddiqa, I have, since I belong to India, I have seen the Bollywood industry, maybe you guys know, is so
and
much.
They had all
like
this problem
India
against hijabi.
Known for its
recently
Bollywood,
in
you know?
India, I saw they're discriminating on the hijabi ladies so much. Yeah.
Well, apart from that discrimination, we always have that.
Yeah.
India is known for its Bollywood industry and Bollywood.
Yeah.
In the previous days, like when I was a kid, if a woman was less dressed, if a woman was if she was selling her body or kind of that, it was shown as a very bad thing those days in the films or movies, or even we have so many songs, the Indian songs, which say like, as the time changed, the clothes of the woman got lessened and all. So we had these songs which kind of were against this changing trend that
women
I noticed
some of the saris are more modest than others.
True.
The sari,
we had this. But as the time changed, we have a porn actress today, as a Bollywood actress today, a porn actress was got into the Bollywood industry and now she's doing the maximum number of films than the normal actresses. And the normal actresses who were doing films in the 90s are today marrying the businessmen and all to, you know, to move on. Because the porn actors are being got into this industry now. What do you think, what changed in between? That's something that was not considered to be modest yesterday is now considered to be a very bold thing. Well, you are listening to Back to Reality. Here we need to take a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Since I'm from India and I was also in the media industry for the past 10 years now, so obviously I also got those offers and I was told if you remove hijab for a movie or for any other thing, you are more bold. They challenge you that to be bold, you have to actually remove your hijab. So where do these concepts arise from, that you are a bold lady if you do not have a hijab, if you're showing off?
This is a personal opinion. I think that initially the way women were treated in society, there was a lot of suppression on them. There was a lot of downtrodden on them.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point something burst in them. And, you know, you had this whole revolution of the women coming out.
Feminist
and asking
revolution.
For the basic rights. And Islam had already given these rights. But we know that these rights, let's face it, culture is not religion. And you come from India. I have an Indian background as well. And let's face it, the way we treat our women within culture is not representative of Islam in any way. We really put them down. One of it is forced marriage, right?
True.
Islam doesn't allow it. But in our culture, it's absolutely what my father says, you have to do it. A topic for another day.
They had it here too, but it was more in the past, yeah.
Yeah, but because there was such suppression and then something broke and women broke up and they started asking for their rights. Fine, good, right? You deserve to be. But then somewhere along the line, they lost the goal of feminism.
They lost the track.
Yeah, feminism is not about showing off as much flesh as you want or getting what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes if we just go back and start redefining feminism to mean the best for a woman without lowering herself,
mm-hmm.
right? Today, a porn actress is allowed to be a porn actress because it means she's able to express herself. My dear, you're not expressing yourself in any way. You are just lowering yourself for the mere pleasure of, you know, someone watching on the other side. And we know this happens. It's not a secret. What happened now, when it comes down to this whole idea of being bold, it's more about we started normalizing this whole trend.
Mm-hmm.
Women appearing as porn actresses, women appearing in Bollywood, you know, hijabi women on
Instagram and other things.
Not Instagram, and also hijabi women on fashion shows.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Going, wearing fashion, wearing clothes that is a fashion statement while having a hijab. And, you know, we started normalizing all of it. So slowly, as we started normalizing, those boundaries started getting smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, obviously, being a porn actress is normal. It's not, it's bold, considered bold, because now you're going against the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
Because we normalize going against the status. A woman's honor is not how much flesh she can show. It is in herself. Like, going back to Jawadi Amuli, Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, who's a scholar in Qom, he has written a whole book on hijab, right? And Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli is a philosopher as well, one of the best today. And he writes hijab from a very philosophical perspective. And one of his quotes that I remember right now, and I'm not quoting exactly from the book, but I'm just giving a point about what he says. He says the hijab is not the right of your husband that when he says you remove it, you remove it. It's not the right of your father or your son or your mother. It is haqqullah. It is the right of Allah that he has given you.
Mm-hmm.
You have to take care of it.
True.
It's for you. It is something that belongs to you as a woman. It is your connection between you and Allah. It is your connection. It is your means of spirituality towards Allah.
Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, Sadiqa. Thank you so much, Fatima. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIP English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, Letti Umarazaka. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, Letti Umarazaka. Let us see daylight again. Once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As they go about their day, millions of Britons are consumed with one big question: how to make ends meet in the year ahead as the impact of the cost of living crisis kicks in.
It brings a lot of frustration because we know that energy companies, like very recently BP and other companies, are posting the highest ever profits. So it almost feels really unfair. And definitely it's going to have an impact on some families.
I can't even save in. Now you've got to allocate that money for other places, you know, for feeding your family, your kids. Everything's gone up. Petrol's gone up. So houses now, you might have to put that in a back burner or wait a bit to until things better.
The cost of living crisis has barely begun, but the alarm bells are already ringing.
The numbers are pretty stark. Inflation is at a 30-year high. Thousands of people could face eviction as that inflation could feed through into the housing market. More than 5 million Britons already have to choose between food and heating, as the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey warns of apocalyptic food prices in the months ahead.
Not everyone is impacted. Bearing the brunt, low-income households, not only on their finances, but also on their health. The stress from soaring energy and food costs is preventing one in two people in Britain from looking after their well-being, with some even not affording to travel to hospital.
I can't sleep at night. Last night I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I've been up since then because of these prices. It's just, you know, what can you do?
The culprit for all this, a cocktail of Brexit, the pandemic and the Russian military conflict in Ukraine. Britain was one of the first countries banning Russian energy imports. The impact of that decision now felt by the people here.
The government really needs to look into this thoroughly, how they can help people out there to find a job. People that have lost their businesses along the line, they need to look into that as well, how to maybe they need to sustain them, provide funding.
The UK government says it's providing support worth over $24 billion within the next year to help families with the pressures from the increasing cost of living. The big question is, will it work? Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rising electricity, gas, oil, petrol, and food prices are drastically pushing the standard of living down for millions of citizens across the 27-nation EU. The European Commission's flagship annual conference focusing on the economy has been told things could get much worse.
In addition to the fact that the war could escalate, sanctions and counter-sanctions could create further problems, there is also the fact that in China, growth is slowing.
The Brussels Economic Forum 2022 also heard that financial pressures, mainly resulting from the conflict in Ukraine, are disproportionately impacting young adults in precarious jobs.
We're picking up incredible increases and disconcerting increases in anxiety, stress, depression, burnouts.
Some analysts suggest untold misery is being piled on citizens because the West purposely ignored Russia's legitimate security concerns. We have been seeking opinions on the current economic pressures.
A person who is employed
he can survive, but just think about a person who is not employed, how it is impacting him.
If we don't have also like kind of a push on the wages, we will not be able to cope with that, and our reserves, our savings, we will go down.
It will go until the point where people understand, okay, this is the peak, we cannot do anymore, and then let's see what's happened, I don't know.
Not only the energy, but the prices of food, the prices of transport. So everything is much more higher.
Driving the EU's foreign policy, critics say Washington has put the bloc in an unwinnable situation. There was no mention of that by key speakers at the Brussels conference.
Thanks to our unity, we have seen that swift and sweeping sanctions can have enormous force.
Enormous force for who? Russia's currency, the ruble, is doing very well, and the Federation is benefiting from rising energy prices. Experts warn of catastrophe if the Kremlin decides to cut off its gas supplies to the EU. As one contributor at the Brussels Economic Forum put it, there is no economy without energy. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Palestine Embassy in Rome has placed in its premises a condolence book for people to express their grief and condemn the brutal killing of Palestinian veteran journalist Shirin Abu Akla. Shirin was covering the Israeli troops' raid in Jenin for Al Jazeera last Wednesday when she was shot in the head by Israeli forces. Her tragic death and the beating of Palestinian mourners during Shirin's funeral sent shockwaves across the region.
I know Shirin personally. My reaction was crying for hours. We felt really sorry, deeply inside. We felt sorry because we feel that we are alone. Where is the international community? Why they are staying silent for suffering of 14 million Palestinians?
On Tuesday, a number of Italian lawmakers went to visit the Palestinian ambassador to Rome to sign the condolence book for Shirin. The delegation of parliamentarians sat with the Palestinian diplomat to discuss how to get the Italian government involved in urging the international community to break its silence in regards with Israeli crimes.
We will file a parliamentary motion in which we demand the government to commit to set up an international investigation committee on what happened in Jenin and during the journalist's funeral.
The United Nations and the European Union, among others, have called for a full investigation into Shirin's assassination, described by many as a deliberate killing in cold blood. Problems have once again emerged in reporting the truth regarding the Israel-Palestine conflict. That comes as most mainstream media have provided a biased portrayal of the assassination of Shirin Abu Akla, omitting Israel's responsibility and considering as facts only the statement issued by the Israeli Defense Forces.
Unfortunately, it is a total double standard when it comes to Italian newspapers reporting on the Israel-Palestine conflict. When there are clashes in that region, journalists say Palestinians die while Israelis are killed.
Thousands of Palestinians residing in Italy have commemorated the Nakba through a number of small and large initiatives. They say the assassination of Shirin is one of the many ways Tel Aviv seeks to silence those that expose the apartheid regime. Max Civili, Rome.
Final results of Lebanon's parliamentary elections are out, with Hezbollah and its allies securing at least half of the seats in the legislative body. The Minister of Interior stressed that the election process was complex and difficult, but free and fair.
With regards to the percentage of voters and the population of Lebanon and the circumstances surrounding the elections, it was a successful election and can be considered a significant achievement. The incidents which took place are marginal and very few in relation to the number of districts and polling stations and ballot boxes, which were around 6,900. These elections were fair and credible.
Despite the political silence during the declaration of the results, analysts believe commotion is yet to come.
Despite of the results, which are almost a tie, I believe that the other camp will keep trying to promote this agenda of disarming Hezbollah. And of course, on the other hand, Hezbollah will try to fail their plans. But while doing so, the Americans and their allies in Lebanon will further deteriorate the economic situation as to blame Hezbollah.
Newcomers to the parliament include members of civil society, which are reportedly sponsored by the United States. The Lebanese forces and its allies also secured a relatively large bloc and could step up their anti-resistance rhetoric.
They were sponsored by the United States, and part of the sponsorship is to promote this agenda, which is to call for disarming Hezbollah as a mean to isolate Lebanon from the Arab-Israeli struggle and facilitate the deal of the century to pass.
The new parliament is set to meet within 15 days to elect its executive council and a speaker of the parliament. In the aftermath of the Lebanese parliamentary elections, many fear that the polarization reflected in the campaigns preceding the elections could be manifested in parliament, leading to a political paralysis. Will the foes succeed in putting aside controversial issues and work together towards financial recovery? Or are there foreign interests that require that a war of attrition against the resistance continues? Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Petrovsky, a district of Donetsk. The front line is only a few kilometers away. The Ukrainian army has been shelling the district since 2014, and since the war with Russia began, the shelling has intensified. A school, two shells landed yesterday in the playground.
Yesterday in the morning, approximately from 8 until 9, two missiles hit here, from either Novomikhailovka or Krasnogorovka. You could hear some whistling and two explosions. One hit the big tree over there, another hit over here. And 18 windows in the school were damaged.
The janitor cleans up the glass from the shattered windows to the sound of outgoing artillery fired by the Donbass separatists. The janitor at that school told us that another school had been hit just a few hours ago in Petrovsky, so we're going there now to see what damage has been done. A branch blown off and shattered glass. It is fortunate the children here are currently learning from home.
I found some shrapnel, deadly pieces of shrapnel that would kill or injure anybody nearby. And it's strange here seeing people still walking about and looking out their windows. At any time, one of these missiles could hit them.
Another recent strike on an apartment building. Two people were confirmed killed. 20 meters away, children play. Since 2014, over 100 children have been killed by Ukrainian shelling, and over 14,000 people in total. We hear of more shelling today on some houses.
No, my house was hit on 3rd of May. Not today. Not directly my house, but my fence was damaged by shrapnel. Today, house number 30 was hit. Let's go.
A few houses along, another fence destroyed.
What happened? The shooting started and we couldn't understand where it was from. Then we heard a rustling sound. It was above our heads. It hit once, twice, the third, then the fourth hit here. I saw the smoke and thought there was a fire.
While thousands of people have left Petrovsky, many, like Yulia, prefer to stay. They have nowhere else to go and prefer living under shelling than becoming refugees.
What can I say? It happens often. There are many places hit, not only here, but near the roundabout, the big supermarkets, and people die every day. When will it end?
So, why do you not leave here?
Where should we go? It's our earth, our ground, our houses are here. Why should we go anywhere? We didn't go to shoot at anyone. We have always been here. For what reason they shoot at us?
It's difficult to explain just how strange it is here in Petrovsky district. The people who are still here are leaving their lives in the hands of God or chance. Every day there are dozens of missile strikes here. While it's quiet at the moment, there's usually the constant rumble of incoming and outgoing artillery. While the vast majority of shelling in this war is being done by Russia, who currently have air and artillery superiority, the uncomfortable truth is that Ukraine is also killing civilians. indeed as it sees it, its own civilians. And they have been doing so for the last 8 years. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The Hungarian government, led by Viktor Orban, is attracting scathing criticism from other EU nations. Citing an enormous economic impact, Orban is refusing to agree on an EU-wide ban on oil being imported from Russia. The impasse was discussed at length by EU foreign affairs ministers on Monday. They have agreed to send €500 million to Ukraine for weapons to fight Russia, bringing the total so far to €2,000 million. The EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, boasts that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the money spent by the EU on weaponizing Ukraine.
Apart from these 2,000 million, the member states do a lot from their side without asking for refunding.
Also on Monday, Borrell warned leaders from Western Balkans countries they will have no chance of joining the EU unless they toe the line.
To maintain close ties with the Putin regime is no longer compatible with building a common future with the European Union.
EU foreign ministers say it's essential that the bloc diversifies its energy supply chains. Experts point out that, after Russia, Iran has the world's second largest oil reserves.
If there is a comprehensive nuclear agreement, then slowly this definitely opens a window of opportunity to have supply lines with a country like Iran. Why not?
The cost of living across the 27-nation EU is rising by the day. Finland and Sweden look set to join NATO. The West continues to deliver weapons to Ukraine. There is massive uncertainty regarding energy security. Experts say the West has no interest in normalizing relations with Russia. For this reason, economists are warning things will almost certainly get much worse for EU citizens before they get better. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The first commercial flight has landed at Sana'a International Airport almost 7 years after the Saudi-led coalition forced the facility to shut down its ordinary air travel. The opening takes place 6 weeks behind the schedule after a UN brokered ceasefire was enforced in early April. This is due to repeated delays by the Saudi-led coalition under different pretexts.
Today, the first civilian plane has arrived at Sana'a Airport after a closure that lasted for more than 6 years, and there is a flight that will go to Amman Airport in Jordan carrying 130 passengers. The turnout is large, and people are eager to travel through Sana'a Airport amid the exceptional circumstances and the large number of patients. We call on the United Nations and all international organizations to demand that the Saudi-led coalition stop its siege and open the airport without any restrictions.
Officials say thousands of patients are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Keeping the airport closed has pushed many Yemeni patients desperate to seek medical treatment abroad to the brink amid their critical health conditions.
We were not able to travel through another airport because of the difficulty of traveling by road and the rugged roads. As my health situation was critical and I couldn't take the long way to another city.
There was a deliberate delay by the Saudi-led coalition to operate flights through Sana'a's airport, especially since 41 days have passed since the implementation of the UN brokered truce. We hope that Yemeni civilians will profit from the opening of the airport, that the truce will be extended, and that the airport will continue to be operational, as it's a civilian airport that does not serve any military authority.
Under the two-month truce that was brokered by the United Nations at the beginning of April, there should be two flights from Egypt and Jordan and back there every week. However, the truce will end in 2 weeks and the terms of the armistice have not yet been implemented.
People here hope that the UN brokered truce will be extended and that Sana'a International Airport will always be open to humanitarian flights, as it is a humanitarian necessity to save the lives of thousands of patients, including children, who are waiting for the chance to travel abroad for treatment. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It was supposed to ensure seamless post-Brexit trade between the UK and the EU. Instead, the Northern Ireland Protocol, in place since last year, is now in danger of falling apart, and with it, peace on the island.
the most recent reason the outcome of the elections in Northern Ireland earlier this month. The Republican Party Sinn Féin came top for the first time ever. The country has a system of power sharing between Republicans who want Northern Ireland in the Republic of Ireland and Unionists who wanted to remain in the UK. And the second largest party in these elections, the Democratic Unionist Party, refuses to accept the protocol, saying it undermines its position in the UK.
This protocol is bad for the economy of Northern Ireland. It's bad for the economy and the Union of the United Kingdom. And in our view, it is that Union of the United Kingdom which shelters Northern Ireland, protects Northern Ireland, provides opportunities for Northern Ireland.
The Irish Sea border for trade, enshrined in the Northern Ireland Protocol, part of the post-Brexit withdrawal agreement, aimed at avoiding a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. The unionists here say they want the protocol scrapped altogether. Westminster now says it's prepared to make changes to parts of it. But to the EU, that is anathema.
The unionists say they're not entering into government with Sinn Féin if the protocol isn't resolved. And the EU says renegotiating an international agreement such as the protocol is simply not acceptable.
Unilateral action, effectively disapplying the protocol, is not the solution for the way forward. The Commission stands ready to continue working in this way because our ultimate goal is to protect the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in all its dimensions, and we urge the UK to do the same.
The UK has so far not budged. Instead, it's now threatening once again to pull the plug on the protocol altogether, leaving many wondering why it signed up to it in the first place.
Boris Johnson clearly wanted to get Brexit done, and so he promised just about anything to the unionists to get them to agree. At the same time, the unionists had a vested interest in staying good friends with the British, the Westminster government, because a rift with them would be very damaging for the unionist cause. Now they've got to live with those consequences.
It's a difficult, self-inflicted conundrum for the UK government led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson on a visit to Belfast trying to break the impasse. On the one hand, he has to satisfy the unionists to protect power sharing and that 1998 peace deal that put an end to decades of sectarian violence between the Republicans and unionists in Northern Ireland, and on the other, avoid a trade war with the European Union. Saeed Purza, Belfast, Northern Ireland.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
This particular targeted killing of a journalist, not the first and sadly probably not the last, touched us all. And the response of the Zionist establishment as well as Washington is cold and full of excuses. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Miko Pled, journalist. This article is published under the heading, "Will Shirin Abu Akleh's murder mark a turning point in liberation of Palestine?" Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The world is trying to make sense of the brutal assassination of Al Jazeera journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, who was targeted by the Zionist regime forces while covering yet another Israeli assault on Jenin. Furthermore, the Zionist regime forces have now attacked the funeral procession leading Shirin to her final resting place. One wonders, why is anyone surprised? How often have we seen innocent lives taken? How often have we seen the Zionist regime's military attack funeral processions? And yet, for reasons that perhaps cannot be explained, awe, sadness, and despair have descended upon the world with this particular killing. This particular targeted killing of a journalist, not the first and sadly probably not the last, touched us all. And the response of the Zionist regime and Washington is cold and full of excuses. On the same day, the funeral procession of Shirin was taking place in Al-Quds. A memorial procession was taking place in the ancient city of Lid. This procession was to commemorate the murder of Musa Hassouna. It was a year ago in Lid, as settler gangs were assaulting Palestinians in Lid, that Musa Hassouna was murdered. This procession, besides being a memorial to the killing, was also a reminder that the Zionist regime's authorities decided to close the case against the only suspects who were on the scene and who fired their weapons at the same place and the same time as Musa was killed. Sources in Lid say that the Zionist regime's Minister of Interior called the local DA to demand that they close the case on grounds of self-defense. Of course, we are all well aware that Musa and Shirin, who were murdered 1 year apart, were not the only victims of the Zionist regime's violence. They were joined by countless others who, without cause or trial, were taken from their loved ones, from their people, and turned into martyrs for the cause. Sure enough, once again, we are forced to look at reality in the face and accept that no one will save Palestine, but all people around the world united. No one else can free Palestine. No one can save Palestinians from the long, violent, heartless arm of the Zionist apartheid regime. Only a unity of purpose and an uncompromising pro-Palestinian, pro-justice, pro-liberation agenda can save Palestine and its people from bloodshed and destruction. Contrary to the common misconception regarding the pro-Palestinian camp, a clear and uncompromising message regarding Palestine does have the capacity to unite people of different backgrounds, faiths, and even political affiliations. One is hard-pressed to think of any other issue on which all of these groups could find common ground. Yet, Al Alda, New York, with its message of a free, decolonized Palestine, managed to do just that. The misconception is that in order to present the Palestine case, in order to achieve the goals of those of seek to free Palestine, we must go slow. We must first crawl before we walk and run, we are told. In other words, in order to achieve the liberation of Palestine, we must tread lightly so as not to upset anyone. This was never true, and it is not true today. The opposition to the cause of justice has always been fierce, and in the case of Palestine, the Zionists have learned from other oppressors and refined their methods. This means that the struggle for justice and liberation in Palestine is challenging and demanding. And we who stand on the side of justice and liberation have to work harder and smarter than those who had to fight in the other arenas. We need to reclaim Palestine by teaching the world that what they wrongly refer to as Israel is actually occupied Palestine, and that a glorious history was cut out from the curriculum, and therefore they don't know about the long impressive history of this land, Palestine, which sits at a crucial crossroads uniting Asia, Africa, and Europe. We need to teach the world that whatever the Zionists had told them was a lie. And then we must be there and, in no uncertain terms, provide the truth.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrowshahi.
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia scholars, jurists, and philosophers all across the world of Islam. I'm Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. Sheikh Ziyaniya, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding jurists and bibliographers of the Shia world. He is no one but Muhammad Mohsen ibn Ali Munzavi Tehrani, mainly known as Agha Bozorg Tehrani. And most of the Shia scholars' original name might differ from their nickname. But for today's discussion, we want to talk about Agha Bozorg Tehrani, the author of the magnum opus, Az-Zariya ila Tasanif al-Shia. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's get to you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Agha Bozorg Tehrani is born in 1293, according to lunar calendar, in one of the traditional districts of Tehran named Pamenar. Mm-hmm. That is close to the actually business area, or what is called also in English as a bazaar, because his father was one of the religious businessmen at that time in Tehran. So Agha Bozorg started his scholarly life when he was 7 years old, So when he was around 15 years old, he went to Najaf in order to benefit from the scholars of Najaf. And if we want to continue chronically to talk about his lifestyle, we have to stay for a long time. He stayed in Samarra. So from Najaf, he moved to Samarra. He stayed there. He benefited from the great ulamas over there, including Muhammad Taqi Shirazi, who was known as the second Mirza Shirazi. And our listeners, they're familiar with Mirza Shirazi because of his actually role in the Shia history. So again, because of the situation of the city Samarra being surrounded by all Sunni district, he was forced to leave Samarra. So for the actually last part of his life, he was staying in Najaf. He benefited from the very outstanding ulama, including Mirza Hussein Nuri, Akhund Mullah Muhammad Kazim Khorasani, the author of actually Kifayatul Usul, and Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tabatabai Yazdi, who is the author of Urwatul Wusqa.
That's right.
And we talked about all of these authors, alhamdulillah, in this program of The Teacher, alhamdulillah, our listeners are familiar with. So, Atullah Sheikh Agha Buzurg Tehrani, as you mentioned, he is considered as the great biographers as well as bibliographers of Shia.
That's right.
And also we can count two very important Shia books being authored by this great author. One is Tabaqat Alam al-Shia and the other is Al-Dhariya ila Tasanif al-Shia.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Mahdawi. Let's get to Sheikh Ziya in order to have his explanation on these two outstanding books, Al-Dhariya. Let's start with Al-Dhariya ila Tasanif al-Shia. What is this book? And mainly Agha Buzurg Tehrani is known with this book. I mean, the author of Al-Dhariya, Sahib Al-Dhariya, isn't it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you mentioned, my dear brother, Marhum late Ayatollah Agha Buzurg Tehrani is named as Sahib Al-Dhariya, and people or the scholars even may know him with this title, Sahib Al-Dhariya. That shows that this book is really a great work of him. And Al-Dhariya ila Tasanif al-Shia is a, we should say that is an encyclopedia about the books that are written by Shia scholars. And I should say at this point at the beginning of my discussion that why a scholar like Agha Buzurg Tehrani comes to this point to write such a book.
Yes.
Or to compile such a book.
What is the main intention?
The point is that his son is quoting that when Georgi Zeidan, a Christian scholar, says is talking about Muslim Ummah, he says that, okay, at the beginning of Muslim history or Islamic history, there are not that much Shia scholars. And we should say that maybe the beginning years of Islamic history is flourished through the books or through the activities of Sunni scholars. That's why great Allama Agha Buzurg Tehrani comes to this point, okay, that I should compile such a book to introduce the books and also the scholars, because yes, in Tabaqat A'lam al-Shia he introduces the scholars of Shia. So in Al-Dhari'a, he tries to introduce the books that are written by the great scholars of Shia, and the number of 53,510 books are introduced in this book. And you know that this is not the way to say, okay, for example, Al-Kafi is written by a Shia scholar. No, he names the book and then defines how the writer has compiled this book, defines the publications of the book, defines the time of the book in which the book is published, define the somehow the books that are related to this book, for example, the complementaries. So this is very important.
That's right.
And that's why I say that this is an encyclopedia regarding, yes, the books that are written in Shia. So, and we should notice that the book of Al-Dhari'a is written during a time that there was no computer in access.
Yes.
And I don't know how, you know, powerful,
yes,
and enabled was the memory of late Agha Buzurg Tehrani to memorize and to, you know, collect all these, you know, and informations in his mind.
That's
and
right.
Try to analyze them and write such a book.
As I have a picture in front of my face now, my monitor, a picture of Agha Bozorg. You know, he is an old man writing on a piece of paper. Around him, so many pieces of papers and notes are over there. This is how sincere he was, you know. And it's really difficult by writing out the note, taking the notes, classifying them in an alphabetical format, you know, because they say Azariya is in alphabetical. This makes it really, really difficult by checking out different resources and the books, which were mostly in manuscripts. And we know that reading out the manuscripts needs its own special talent and power too.
Yeah.
For example, we today, in today's world, if they give us a manuscript in Persian or Arabic or even in English, reading it out, the text, the mere text, might be a difficult task.
The language is your mother tongue, but you cannot read the text.
You cannot read the text.
The handwriting itself is, you know, very difficult.
Yeah, and you know, Agha Bozorg Tehrani did that. So this is only, Azariya is about only the references, is it? Or the scholars and the books?
The books, not the scholars.
Not the scholars, the books. But, you know, the other book is about
Tabaqat
what?
Alamushya.
Tabaqat Alamushya is about the authors.
Okay, regarding Tabaqat Alamushya, as we see, the title of the book is speaking to us. It's talking about the different, actually, period of time in which authors of Shia have been living in. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to employ a very nice manner for dividing his book into different chapters. So he is counting from the 4th century till 14th century, 11th century. Actually, he is saying that, okay, this 11th century is the number of the occultation, I mean the bigger occultation of Imam Asr, and based on this, I'm trying to count the Shia authors in each century, starting from the beginning up to now. Mm-hmm. So this is also was in response to the accusations.
Yes.
What my brother mentioned regarding Georgi Zeidan, it was not only limited to Georgi Zeidan. She actually, school of thought at his time, it was really attacked by different authors of having no back, having no history, having no lineage. So as it is mentioned, Azariya Lotasanif Shira was in favor or in charge of introducing Shia works, but this Tabaqat Alam Shia, it's a very big 20 volumes regarding the biographies of all Shias who have been living from the 4th century till 14th century. Even he tries to include some of the Sunni authors who have this inclination about the school of thought of Ahlul Bayt and who love school of thought of Ahlul Bayt and Ahlul Bayt. He tries to include those authors also in his book. And this is one of the criticism for him,
right,
that if you call your book as Tabaqat Alam Shia, then these minor names are included there. So it could be justified that he was trying to
give a complete
kind of encyclopedia of all authors, the biography of all authors who were loving Ahlul Bayt. So this is actually one of the good things in response to all accusations which are attacking Shia of not having any history, academic history.
You know, some Mustadrakat or additions, you know, were written to Azariya. The most outstanding ones were by Abdulaziz Tabatabai, Abdul Hussein Hayri, Muhammad Ali Rozati Isfahani, and Muhammad Tabatabai Behbahani. Some of the things that might be missed by Agha Bozorg Tehrani were added to this book, but according to Muhammad Tabatabai Behbahani, it was only 500 titles which were added to the book, so it shows that it was not many. And I think that Agha Bozorg Tehrani at his time did a great work and did not miss anything regarding the Shia books and the Shia scholars. Any other point missed?
Yeah. Something that is very interesting regarding the writing the book Azariya is that, okay, the scholarly aspect of the book of Azariya is done by late Agha Bozorg Tehrani, but we should consider another aspect of writing this book, and that is the publication of the book.
Mm-hmm.
When Agha Bozorg Tehrani tries to publish this book, his uncle, that was a merchant in Tehran, he assisted Aga Bozorg Tehrani regarding the publication of the book. The uncle gave a bunch of money to Aga Bozorg Tehrani in order to sponsor him.
That's right.
And to enable him to establish a publication. And then Aga Bozorg Tehrani tries to publish his books, his great work, with the money that is gifted by his uncle.
That's
so
right.
I want to highlight this point that in Islamic history or Shia school of thought history, when we trace back the books that are written, most of the time we come to this point that great works are done by scholars, but many times we see some people that they are in shadow.
That's
and
right.
They are not famous,
yes.
But they are also the ones who assisted the scholar
right.
to publish his
okay.
book. And this is very important because whenever a person or a scholar or
yes.
anybody refers to the book Al-Dari'a,
yes.
the uncle of Aga Bozorg Tehrani also is
that's right.
taking benefit from his
yes.
studies because the uncle also is involved in publication of the book.
And they are commemorated too. And we know that the past generation of the businessman and the market man were in close relation with the religious authorities and the religious men, you know?
Yeah.
To asking their religious questions or to helping the poor. And, you know, the market was really very much different from the market that we have in today's world. So it's better to say that the patrons or the supporters and the protectors of the true legacy of the Shia world had been financially supported by the businessmen of the markets of the Islamic lands too.
And this is very important.
Yes.
When we ourselves are not able to do, you know,
yes.
scholarly activities,
yes, we can support
then
the other
we
way.
Can support the one who is doing it correctly and truly, and then we are, inshallah, have a share of thawab and rewards.
Inshallah. That's all right. Zulhijjah 13th, 1389, according to the Hijra calendar, at the age of 96, Sheikh Aga Bozorg Tehrani passed away, and according to his last will and testament, his body was taken to his own library and he was buried over there. He has a great library, we can say, which is the source of benefit for so many outstanding scholars. May Allah bless the soul of Aga Bozorg Tehrani, the author of Az-Zari'a ila Tasanif al-Shia and also Tabaqat A'lam al-Shia. May he rest in peace, inshallah. And thank you, Omar Sheikh Ziyaniya and Sheikh Mahdavi for your explanation regarding the life of Sheikh Aga Bozorg Tehrani. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/ Shia and Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel, Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode introducing another Shia dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.